My name is Roy Malloy, and this is the first podcast I've put out in a very long time. Work and homeschooling and all the other bits and pieces that go with it make it a challenge, to be honest. But here it is. This is another podcast about true crime and a bunch of things that I've been researching. I love the process of researching probably more than the actual aspect of writing. Also, you're going to hear chirps from my budgie. Frankie likes to think that she's part of the recordings. And you'll get to love her as much as I do. But one of the things I love about researching has always been, I think you'd call it kind of like gold mining, where you have these little moments where you unearth something you've been hunting for. And sometimes you don't even know what you're missing. I found myself writing about Squizzy in the Squizzy Taylor book, a bit about his car. And he very famously had a blue Hudson, and the number plate was 771. And there had been a previous newspaper article about Squizzy speeding through the city of Melbourne in another car that they didn't mention a make or model, only that it was extremely powerful. That's just one little bit of information that I'd kind of retained. I mentioned it in the biography, but I didn't have the ability to really research anything more than the fact that he had another car. The speed he was travelling at the time was 20 miles an hour, and that was considered outrageous for the time. So it's how we've all changed. But a lot of the things that you could never really find out as a historian are the kinds of things that only the people who were there at the time could tell you. There tend to be things about physical nuances. So as you get really close to a person you're researching, you do find yourself wondering, did they have any peculiar mannerisms? How did they sit in a seat? What brand of cigarettes do they prefer? Were they a messy or a fast eater? Little things that if you saw them do it in person, you might actually think to yourself, well, that kind of is another piece to the puzzle. And they're the kinds of things you can only really glean from someone reaching out and saying, look, I happen to know this because I have an oral tradition in our family. As a researcher, one of the incredible frontiers of things that we try and find include letters or diaries. And I think really top of the pile would be something in the person's own voice in the form of a cassette or an audio interview. And that just happened to be what came my way recently. So in a bunch of the posts I put on social media, I've reached out and said, look, I'm looking for anything, and posted stories about Squizzy or the area, and also the criminals around him. And a member of a family called the Hanson family came my way and said, look, we've got this recording that Dad made. It was made on cassette tape, and they're notorious for losing information over time, cassettes. They're on a kind of digital magnetic strip, which drops the physical magnet parts of it over time, and you lose quality to the point where you can't always hear what the person's actually saying. But they told me that they had this cassette tape of Oliver Hanson talking about his own childhood in Richmond in that time and place. So it became incredibly important to me to hear this cassette, and I can't stress how incredible it was, and I hope you're also going to enjoy it. But to hear the actual first-hand accounts of somebody who had real lived experience living directly across the road from Squizzy Taylor. A couple of the things that he filled in, they're the kinds of things you really can't make up. And you'll hear him talk about the kind of car that he noted that Squizzy had, and it wasn't the Hudson with the number plate 771. It was the other car that I couldn't quite find. And I've also looked for this kind of car, and if there's even one of it in Australia now, to be a miracle. They weren't a large production number car in the first place, but they were renowned for being incredibly powerful. I dare say it could go a lot faster than 20k an hour. But he also talks about, I guess it might be a bit apocryphal where he talks about that Squizzy controlled all crime in that area, but it does sit pretty closely alongside a lot of the other things that you kind of read between the lines, or you hear media pieces where they say that Squizzy ran Richmond, ran the crime in the area. And so what he says really is a very interesting take on what it would have been like to live around somebody who was openly flaunting the fact that they were an incredibly famous criminal at that time. The piece of land that the house was on also, if you're inclined to look, and that's one of the first things I always do is I Google the address for a house whenever somebody lists it or tells me where it was. It's now a part of a school. It's a tennis court, as he says in the interview, which is fascinating as well. But the explosion as well is, he talks about an explosion in the cassette tape, and that's also something that's covered pretty extensively in the Squizzy Taylor biography. And it crosses over a little bit with one of the Dawn of Crime series that I published. If you're not familiar with the Dawn of Crime, while I've been researching the Squizzy Taylor biography or any of the bigger biographies I've done, I come across this secondary group of information, and they tend to be biographies of people that it's necessary to learn who they are to give context to the person I'm researching. So what ends up happening is I find all this information out about a person who isn't Squizzy, and remembering when I've been writing the Squizzy Taylor biography, it has been exclusively a biography about Squizzy and Squizzy alone. I come up with all this other secondary stuff, and it just seems like sacrilege to put it all together then not publish it. So I began publishing a series of books called The Dawn of Crime. I think they're about $12 or $14 each on the publishing site that I use. And each book has 14 or 15 short biographies of the crooks that were around Squizzy or fed into the case somehow. So being able to look at them, one of the cases was the 1920s bombings of Melbourne. And it seems extraordinary today to think about the idea that somebody was detonating full-scale enormous bombs around Melbourne and the suburbs in the 1920s, but it was absolutely happening. And pretty predictably, the targets of them were always gang-related or police themselves who were interfering with gang activity. And there was a psychopath called Timothy O'Connell, by memory, I think that was his name, and he had bomb-making experience, and they got him in the end, O'Connell, but he was part of the Squizzy Taylor story. And again, it's one of those bits of information that when you read through the Squizzy Taylor biography, it's very hard to know exactly how they were related, how they met, what their deals were going to be, had they not been caught. But, you know, surely out there, maybe somewhere, there's a descendant of Timothy O'Connell who can say, yeah, look, I know the other piece to that, and here's a cassette tape of my great-grandfather telling his story. Who knows? But there's just so many pieces to the puzzle that are yet to fall in place. But I can't tell you how grateful I am to the Hanson family for letting me play this interview to you. It's an incredible piece of history that I'm so happy is now being preserved. But the same principle goes, if you are out there and you have a letter or a diary or you know, anything along those lines that you feel could tie into 1920s law and order, I'd love to offer that, you know, that kind of ability to place it alongside the other bits and pieces that fill in the puzzle. I do center all of my work on that very particular time and period because you just can't be all things to all people, I guess. It's impossible to be any broader. Otherwise, it just becomes somewhat scattergun. But I do specialize in that period of, you know, 1880 to 1930 Australia, crime, law and order. But look, I really would love to hear from you. You can reach out to me on any of my social media. There's my main page is Roy Malloy Author, which is M-A-L-O-Y, and then you've got to put the word author. And send me a message with any of your family stories. I also have a couple of great pages on social media. One of them is called Squizzy Taylor Stories, and another one is called Australian Crime History, where I've published a bunch of more lateral pieces. But I'm going to play the tape for you now, and I really hope you enjoy it. Please remember to share any of the posts that you enjoy, and check out my Roy Malloy Author for information about where you can buy any of the books I've talked about.
Early life in Richmond. Possibly my earliest memory is at roughly 4 years of age of Saturday nights and the pounding of feet as pushers chased each other past our side windows facing onto Lennox Street. At the corner of Lennox Street and Bridge Road, in Lennox Street, was a cab stand where hansom cabs and four-wheeled cabs operated. And father's business, was a licensed grocer, which is still operating as the Melbourne Stores. Initially, we had two horse-drawn delivery carts drawn by ex-fire engine horses. I can't quite remember their names. I think one was Queenie, and the other Blackie. I'm not too sure about that. But they're magnificent beasts. I could climb all over them, walk between their legs, and generally without any fear of them whatsoever. Cable trams were operating in those days, and a favourite child's trick was to tie a rope onto a kerosene tin and allow the rope to dangle down between the centre guides and be picked up by frayed cable ends. The tin then rattled down the street out of sight and presumably was torn off at the end of the line by a stationary tram, or continued on until torn off as the cable went through and back into the power station. At approximately 6 years of age, I started school at Clifton College, the corner of Church Street, just near St. Ignatius. This is now the headquarters of the Pumpkin Players. Frequently I'd walk home via St. Ignatius School and the then attached Vaucluse, previously, or at that time anyway, a rather exclusive residential area that was becoming somewhat seedy, but was extremely interesting with its cast iron front fences, and was actually a private road entered from Lennox Street. Some 18 months ago I visited there and was shocked to find that it was virtually non-existent. A family friend acquaintance was a Scot, Mr. Kinnear, who was then the maintenance engineer for Palaco Shirt Factory, and he lived in a rather large English-style mansion in the Palaco grounds, surrounded by what was once a magnificent garden. As a matter of interest, his sister-in-law was a Miss Bessie Taylor, Sir John Monash's private secretary until his retirement and or death. Opposite the school were a line of smallish houses which have now been taken over by St. Ignatius and tennis courts. But in one of these houses lived Squizzy Taylor, and next door to him one of our typists. Squizzy used to park his motor car, which was a very large and powerful Minerva, a car which has not been built for some 40-odd years. Another lad and myself noticed one day that the car had a flat tyre, and we went across and very fearfully knocked on the door and to inform Squizzy about the flat tyre. We received 2 shillings each. I wish I had kept that 2 shillings. During the police strike of 1923, my father was sworn in as a special constable, and I can date my earliest memories from this time as I can remember travelling in the car with him near the Bourke Street and hearing crashing of glass as mobs ranged up and down looting from Myers, etc. At this time, I vaguely remember our shop windows being boarded up and my father and other shopkeepers plus one or two police standing across Bridge Road with drawn pistols, awaiting a mob that was apparently approaching Richmond from the city. Fortunately, they turned off at Punt Road, so I'm told, and nothing came of it. Sometime after this, possibly 1925, 3 doors away was a motor car firm, and one night, I think it was a Saturday, two tremendous explosions occurred, and the whole place was blown to pieces. Some days later, the police found one or two sticks of gelignite upon our roof. My sister and our two grandmothers and myself were home alone, and my sister carried me across Bridge Road to Mick Canis's cafe, where I was put to bed. Mick Canis and my family were quite friendly. This explosion broke shop windows for several hundred yards up and down each side of Bridge Road. I can vaguely remember playing around the wrecked chassis, which I think were Alfa Romeos, and gossip had it that the reason for the explosion was the inability to sell the cars, and so they were blown up and destroyed in order to collect insurance. After listening to the 3LO interview this morning on your book, The Immigrants, I remember my mother saying that my Norwegian grandmother was instructed not to speak in public with her broken English, obviously a foreign accent, when shopping, but to point to to the articles she required. This applied apparently up to approximately the early 1900s, and of course during the 1418 war. At this time, 1418, it was very hard on Scandinavians, as they were regarded as sympathetic to the Hun. In fact, were virtually forbidden to purchase property and were at risk with the possibility of internment. It's rather interesting today when migrants complain, and I am sympathetic to migrants, but they complain about the way they are treated. Their treatment today is royal compared with the treatment that migrants received in, prior to the 1900s. People from the British Isles regarded all other people as being so inferior that they were just treated as dirt. I've mentioned this to quite a few people with whom I've worked, and they have found it hard to believe that that sort of thing could happen to people so long ago. But this applies to society throughout history, and so is probably just accepted. The pre-war migrant, the so-called refo, regards the post-war migrant as being mollycoddled compared with what she suffered in the prior to 1939. On reviewing this tape, I must apologise as it's somewhat disjointed, rambling, and hesitant. With regard to remarks re-migrants, The workmates I'm referring to are themselves migrants, either one from Israel and several from Germany, Czechoslovakia, and Poland. In general, looking over this again, I seem to have somehow or other come back to Richmond quite a bit throughout my life, either via Prue with Richmond Girls High and friends, hospitals, all that sort of thing. An old friend of my grandmother's, a Mrs. Ward, that lived in a tiny little house in a small street off Lennox Street on the north side of Bridge Road, gave my grandmother, Mrs. maternal grandmother, a rocking chair. Now this delightful old lady, Mrs. Ward, I found out recently from a sister, came from Mauritius. I couldn't quite remember the island at the moment then. However, I can't think of anything of particular interest apart from around about 1926-27 when the cable trams were torn up and the tracks removed to be replaced with electric trams. I walked beneath Bridge Road from Lennox Street to Punt Road and back again to Church Street underground in the cable tunnel. That remark is of no particular interest, except that it's very interesting when talking with a group of people to speak of cable trams and sitting up on the front of the dummy and enjoying the wind rushing past. I think that they went about 10 miles an hour. And to age people by the blank expressions on their faces, they, not having ever seen or known anything about Melbourne's cable trams except as some sort of historical event. But the cable trams were delightful, and it is a pity that they are not retained as a tourist attraction, apart from their lack of general pollution and their quietness. When the cable trams were discontinued, we had difficulty in sleeping at night time early in the evening because the trams ran up to roughly 11, 12 o'clock at night, because we were used to for years the singing of the cable as it just followed across the idler wheels underground. It was quite a distinct noise, which was a background sound that somehow or other, even now, whilst I can't quite recall it, it's an interesting memory of something. Something that has a strange, possibly nostalgic, or happy child memory, simplest way to put it. Regarding the cable trams, as you probably know, they were imported from San Francisco, and I believe they were hired and were originally a private company that was taken over by the Melbourne Metropolitan Tramways Board. But the cable trams would be an interesting exercise for somebody to, if they have not already done so, record their history technically, etc. Regarding this, an interesting or rather a fascinating sight was to stand outside the power stations, one at the corner of Punt Road and Bridge Road and the other down near the Hawthorne Bridge in Bridge Road, but to see this 40-foot wheel with a steam engine driving it that collected the cable from under the road and put energy back into it and pushed it back under the road again. More disjointed thoughts. Ridge Road, Richmond, prior to 1925, at least and or up to the Depression years of 1929 on, provided almost as much variety of goods services as available anywhere else in Melbourne, along with Smith Street, Collingwood and Chapel Street, Paran. My father's shop delivered south of the Yarra and elsewhere imported foodstuffs and liquors from the UK, Europe, USA, etc. Other shops provided furniture, clothing, books, music, equal to any city store. For example, nearly opposite our place was an art craft supply shop whose equivalent does not exist in any one of today's shops, or indeed a combination of several. Friday night shopping was a glittering festival, at least to me. Christmas meant many, many hours of parent time and our shop assistants in preparing window displays, not just tinsel static displays, but colourful moving displays. I always look forward to the dismantling of these window displays. It meant toys for me, including an electric train set for my 7th birthday some 10 months later in 1 year. These displays were costly in material and time. All shops did something like it and foreshadowed Myers Melbourne's Christmas windows, which of course are so much more elaborate with materials etc. available, but nevertheless Christmas meant shop windows. We were burgled several times, most likely by Squizzy Taylor's folk, as little crime occurred in Richmond, unknown to Squizzy. We lost via poison baits, stricken in broken glass, several watchdogs, these dogs being silenced before entry occurred. After the third dog, an Airedale, a small Bitzer, my dog, was kept within the house and shop, safe from bait. My play area is mainly the top floor, third floor, which was two very large rooms connected by several doors. By large, I mean I could ride scooters, trikes around and from one room to the other, also kick a football once through the front windows, showering glass into Bridge Road, frightening the hell out of the shoppers down below. The concrete roads of Richmond were laid about 1925, including that part of Bridge Road from Church Street to Hawthorne Bridge. That is, they lasted 50 odd years before being torn up just recently. Not bad going. Corrections, I've spoken in terms of yards and miles instead of metres and kilometres, which is my present habit. Interesting that the old habit persists where the mind first used it. Clifton College was in the corner of Church Street and Darlington Parade. It's my belief that Richmond should be given an opportunity to recover some of its former glory. Lennox Street, the old Richmond Hill, and places like that would be very good places in which to live. The east side of Lennox Street from Bridge Road down to Swan Street had at one time some very good houses and was a prime part of Richmond, in some respects as good as the so-called Richmond Hill. I remember when Bryant & Mays was lauded as one of the leading industrial factories in the area and in its treatment of its personnel via tennis courts, etc. It was quite a Well, it's still a modern factory in general appearance. I have a lot, I could say, of my thoughts about migrants, their backgrounds and white Australia policy, and the resentment I feel when Australians are referred to as racist for very many reasons. If you're interested in them, you're welcome. So I hope you can follow this, and I hope it is of value to you. Bye-bye. Back again. With respect to recreation, hobbies, and appearance, most of their lives they just worked. Late in my life, my father indulged in a little shooting, fishing, and very late in life, a bit of golf. Another explanation, with reference to refos, that is, of course, pre-1939-45 war. Regarding the foodstuff, foods which were available, around about 1926, heavy tariffs on imported goods was introduced and spelt the end of exotic foodstuffs, which we used to handle liberally. Foodstuffs from California, and as far away as Norway.